This episode is brought to you by Brooklyn Botanic Garden, a stunning 52-acre garden in the heart of Brooklyn, open year-round. Learn more at bbg.org.
This week, Meat and Three is taking you to market and all over the world, from Newfoundland to Tunisia.
Well, a lot of us think of, you know, the British Empire trading things like spices and sugar and silk. But you write that it actually began with salt cod from Newfoundland.
There was a port closure in Tunisia, which was horrible. I mean, it was months, boats just sitting on the water waiting to go, and they couldn't go anywhere.
And we'll learn about how markets have changed, whether because of their customers or the climate.
A few years ago, something around 10 years, it was totally different.
It almost manifests itself to almost smelling like an old fire pit. When you, when you put it out, it has that sort of charcoal-y smell to it. It's not good for wine.
Join us this week on Meat and Three for our global market tour. And don't forget to subscribe to Meat and Three wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Snackytunes. I'm one half your host, Greg Bresnitz. This week, I head down to Lima, Peru to talk to the legendary chef Virgilio Martinez, who's redefined the cuisine of his homeland by diving deep into the country's incredibly diverse ecosystem and indigenous ingredients. His flagship restaurant, Central, is one of the most acclaimed and groundbreaking restaurants in the entire world. Then we head into our archives with one of our all-time favorite Los Angeles performances, Tropa Magica. We head to Dangerwood Records Studio to talk to the East LA natives who are longtime fixtures in the local music scene and how their unique psychedelic cumbia punk sound is sure to get you on your feet and moving. So sit back, relax, and here's another episode of Snacky Tunes.
We talk about food, we talk about music, with musical dudes, finger on the pulse, Snacky Tunes.
Hello and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I'm one half your host, Greg Bresnitz. I'm here in wonderful Lima, Peru, at the brand new, newish Central.
Yeah, it's been new for 1 year.
With Virgilio Martinez.
Virgilio Martinez. Yes.
So nice. I'm, my Spanish is so.
No, it's good. I mean, you've been here traveling, so you had time to learn.
It's time. I need more time. one of the things that's interesting about the history of the country of Peru is you talk about growing up in a bubble in Lima due just to the way that the different regions and the different people were separated. For the people who don't know the history. Can you set the stage where you were a young child and what kind of the cross-communication or lack thereof were between the different regions within the country?
Yeah, it was quite like a funny situation because we were living in Lima, and Lima was the place where we were just like, you know, we didn't think about going to the Andes and the Amazon or just going to Cusco and Arequipa because it was dangerous, and it was like we didn't have any expectations about, knowing our territory, our traditions and stuff like that. So we were all the time just in Lima, and Lima for us was Peru, which, you know, in the end it is not Peru as you may have seen. Like, you know, Peru is more like what you see in the Andes, in the Cordillera de los Andes, what you see in the Amazon, in the jungle. It took me a while to understand that Lima is just a little bit of the modern Peru, which is not in the end, you know, what you feel when you visit Peru.
And was it just you and your immediate family and friends that saw Lima as the center of Peru, or was it the general viewpoint of people who lived in the city? And was it the same for people in Cusco? Cusco was the center of the world. The Andes was the center of the world, and was segmented.
Yeah, of course it was. It was more about our education. I was educated in a way that I felt, or I was taught that Lima was the epicenter of everything. So if I wanted to do something or just to, you know, like being success, it had to happen in Lima. Or it may be if you go like to other country. I remember these times, let's say about 20 years ago, when, you know, we were living on with terrorism and crime, and so it was like not a pretty good place to visit, which is now the opposite. So now it's a good place to visit. Lima is safe. You can travel. You can, you know, the whole Peru is changing. But yeah, you know, for me it was difficult to understand, you know, what was about being Peruvian, because when I go to the Andes and the Amazon, I don't feel like a local Peruvian there. Even in Lima, like, it's difficult to understand, you know, my situation as a Peruvian. So it's a matter of identity. So nowadays, like, it's getting like easier for us to understand, like, you know, our identity as a Peruvian is a whole, this kind of melting pot of, you know, diversity and things that you know, are happening in the same cities, and in the end we're getting along very well.
And what is it in 2019? Does it mean to be Peruvian and a Peruvian chef?
Well, being a Peruvian chef is about knowing your territory and going deep into places that probably you've never thought about being before. You know, you're being a chef here is kind of being an explorer. It's about being somebody who is looking for his own heritage, traditions, and, you know, nowadays, like, I got this feeling, like, for me being a chef, I have to be responsible about, like, knowing what happened, you know, before the colonization, you know, what we Peruvians, we used to eat like a thousand of years ago. I mean, like, that was for me, like, I have this curiosity, and, you know, from my kitchen, I wanna, from my kitchen, from my food, for the food we serve, I wanna express that.
When you were younger, you left, as you said, that you either were going to make it in Lima, or you had to leave to make it. You came back. What was it? Was it a dish or an ingredient or a moment that made your eyes begin to open about the diversity of Peruvian ingredients?
You know, it was as simple as one bunch of potatoes inspired me to see how much diverse is the whole country. I was told once that we had like 3,800 varieties of potatoes, and you know, I had only one recipe to make a potato puree 20 years ago. So I started to ask myself, like, why should I follow recipes that are coming from far away in Europe, where, you know, I'm here in the Andes where the potatoes are grown, and you know, that could be one example of the potato. Then we just go into the Amazon and see all this amazing variety of fruits, cacao, coffee, you know, coffee plantations everywhere. Then I discovered, you know, you can have like a whole great 100% Peruvian fine dining experience using only Peruvians coming from Peru, from olive oil, cacao, coffee, you know, meat, fish, even fish from the river, from the Amazon, fish from the coast, from the Pacific coast, vegetables. So, I mean, for me, it was all about biodiversity, you know, and ingredients.
Once you locked into coming home, the expansiveness of Peru and the unfathomable amount of ingredients. One of the quotes that you have saying is, "We know nothing, that you are a work in progress." Did you feel humbled by the expansiveness of it? How did you begin to tap into the local knowledge? How did you begin your education? And what was the current state of Peruvian cuisine once, you know, you got outside of Lima and started exploring the rest of the country?
You know, it's a good point just starting to if we just start to say like, okay, we know like very little, or probably we know just like probably nothing, because there's so much to be discovered. There's so much things waiting for us. Yeah, I mean, and also we need this curiosity. We need to find ingredients. But we're not supporting like consuming local ingredients, because there are many, of course. I think we need to consume like local knowledge, and this kind of we are trying to encourage people to be focused on research, on working with projects that, you know, that have something, you know, to give to people, to share. I mean, like, for us it's very easy to see farmers and people working in the fields. For us it's very easy to see people with needs. So, I mean, we're in a position to help. That's it.
That's an interesting distinction about taking just, you know, you could go do sourcing, cook it back here, but you have a research center here. What is it the focus of it, and what are the type of projects that you feel are important to the platform that you have and is necessary to continuing the growth?
Well, yeah, just about giving visibility to farmers, to people who is producing amazing stuff and great produce that probably is getting lost in the Andes and in the Amazon. It's very sad to see how people are struggling in the markets, you know, just trying to sell or just trying to survive, you know, with this amazing stuff. And of course, we are in a position where fine dining is becoming a responsibility of, you know, provoking changes. We are not ashamed to say like we are educating people in our restaurant. We're educating the chefs. We're educating ourselves. We're educating our customers. So it's a whole process of understanding our new revolution, if we could be understood that way. We are trying. We're in the process of change, and changes are happening anywhere in the world, you know, and this is important, and I think, yeah, we are responsible of making them. I mean, we have to do change. We have to provoke changes. That's it.
Where does climate change come into your cooking?
The what do you mean?
Well, how does the effect and your thoughts on that as the platform and how it begins to affect the region? Because Peru is, you know, -25 meters below sea level, all the way up to 4,000. So some areas are almost immediately affected because of rising waters, and some it will take centuries to be affected by it outside of changing weather patterns.
Oh, yeah. Well, we see many changes that, you know, like when we start to work with people who were growing ingredients, let's say like corn and quinoa in the Andes, we're seeing how these people were affected by climate changes and how these people were just going up 1,000 meters just, you know, just because of the whole climate, which was changing in the mountains. So for us, I mean, we're having this access to knowledge about, you know, what's going on with people. So I know that you know, if you have to work harder for some ingredients, I mean, we have to put this, you know, this situation in a I mean, we have to make it visible, like, you know, some people are struggling with some crops and stuff. So yeah, here in the coast, I mean, we're working in a, probably in a very Western, you know, style of seeing life. You know, if you go to the Andes and the Amazon, the cosmovision is different, and still we're in the process of just understanding a bit of that.
And to talk about the different philosophies, where they're like a vertically integrated universe as opposed to just kind of that, how were you aware of that growing up? Is that something that as you explored Peru, that type of philosophy and way of seeing the world as, you know, what's below and what's above? How does that like affect
you? Well, there's the duality, like you say, like dualidad, right? Like right or left or up and down and this kind of stuff. I mean, in the Andes, the world in the Andes is very marked, and you know, I met one person. He told me, like, you know, territory is Peru is like a wrinkled paper, and you know, it's full of micro, you know, everything. When you wrinkle a paper, like, you see all these different points. Okay, but this is our territory, you know, these different microclimates are happening. So different seasonalities are working in these different microclimates. So it's very difficult for us to understand seasonality. You know, I was coming from abroad, and I was coming with this structure of seasonality, you know, to respect the seasons. And then I came to Peru, like 25 years ago, well, people were saying, like, what season? I mean, if we're up and down. And so this idea of seeing Peru in altitudes, it's something that is coming from the truth of what people in the Andes believe, because it's more about beliefs, not much about science and religion. You know, the search of the truth is more about beliefs. So yeah, then we start to think about, like, you know, going up and down, and then we start to structure menus or ideas based on the altitudes of being up and down.
It's incredible just to have the range of people and the thoughts and beliefs. Do you find that there's conflicting beliefs as you continue to explore and discover new ecosystems that hold kind of almost a dichotomy, where you'll run into one part of the Andes that holds one set of beliefs, go to the Amazon, another set of beliefs, and then you have to find a way to synthesize it in the restaurant?
I think it's a good example of globalization in a way. Like, you see, you know, different varieties and you know, you see different, you know, ways to the people believe or think or just, you know, live. And yeah, it's quite sometimes quite contradictory. Like, I just cannot say, like, all the people in the Andes, they think in the same way. Like, I mean, like, we work with two communities in our restaurant in Mill, and these two communities, they're very clever, they think in a different way. I mean, if you go to the Amazon, it's another world. And yeah, and now we're actually in Lima, so well, there's a lot of things to do. Of course, gastronomy is amazing to have an approach, you know, on it and just to try to understand. But yeah, as I was saying, like, in the end, like, you get this feeling like you are understanding just a little bit of what's really happening.
Have you seen that different belief systems lead to cooking different types of dishes or using ingredients differently?
Oh yeah, a lot. Like, yeah, using ingredients in a different way, using ingredients, you know, when they are, probably not in the best time or not in the best season, or just, you know, because of beliefs, people is just, you know, preserving ingredients for, you know, for the next 10 years or stuff like that. Or, yeah, we do see that a lot. I mean, the way, just to put just one simple example, just the way people is using the cacao. Like, people don't see cacao as chocolate. People see cacao as a fruit where you chew the white pulp and then you spit up the seed, which is actually the cacao, the chocolate. And many other stuff that, you know, people also use the skin of the whole pot of cacao. So there are many uses that are different, you know, even pachamanca, huacha, you know, when you cook potatoes on the ground or different ingredients on the ground, you know, meat. Every time I go to the Andes, I see different stuff going on and different ingredients.
Do you ever see anything, you know, we now need to go back and change the way we cook that?
Oh yeah, yeah. Like, you know, sometimes I have this feeling that I'm getting lost of information. That's why we have this group, and that's why we created, like, a few years ago, this team of people that really is looking for something like interesting, important, that probably can make a few changes. Things that probably could, things that are working in the restaurant. But then I thought that these things are just going beyond the restaurant. And, you know, in the end, the restaurant is a platform just to showcase that what's happening in the Andes, what's happening in the Amazon. So, we get this feeling that we are having little by little a better approach to understand new things, in my case, I mean, this last year, I've been going to the Andes once. I go to Cusco once a week, maybe, which is a lot. Like, going from Lima to Cusco, door to door, is maybe 3 or 4 hours. I only go for one day or maybe 2 days. But you know, I came back with so much energy, you know, to cook. So it's, in a way, it's changing the way we're working now. I mean, we got the feeling that we're having a unique approach of our nature.
I do understand, having traveled around a bit, why you need to leave Lima sometimes and be refreshed.
Well, Lima is still a chaotic city. I mean, the traffic is crazy. But you know, Lima is becoming now a place where people is coming to eat, and you know, people is, you know, looking for reservations in restaurants, and I would say like Lima is getting crazy. I mean, we've never thought that we were supposed to be in this situation where which is very positive, but where people is coming just for restaurants and it's quite amazing. I need to stay away from Lima once in a while and just go to some natural spaces, natural areas where I get this feeling like I can go on my cooking.
We're gonna take a quick musical break and we'll be right back here on Snacky Tunes.
I had a dream last night. You were there, dancing in my eyes. Yeah, our love was alive in my room. The day broke you from my sights. And baby, I remembered our fight. Now you're no longer mine. How will I make it through tonight? 'Cause we're out of time. Oh, but I miss you tonight. I can't fight it. You got a hold on my mind. They say catch me, baby. Caught me in your web of lies. Now I see the truth. So why do I miss you tonight? I can't fight it. You got a hold on my mind.
This episode is brought to you by Brooklyn Botanic Garden, a stunning 52-acre garden in the heart of Brooklyn featuring spectacular plant displays year-round. Make the most of the last days of summer on Thursday, August 22nd at Brooklyn Botanic Garden's Beer and Bocce Benefit, a one-of-a-kind garden party featuring lawn games, live music, and unlimited beer tastings by some of Brooklyn's top beer makers. Proceeds from the Beer and Bocce Benefit provide essential support for the garden's educational and community programs. Learn more about Brooklyn Botanic Garden at bbg.org.
One of the most interesting things about this restaurant is cooking with unknown ingredients. Most places that you would go to, you know everything down to the herb or the shell that's in there. There's such a confidence. One, with cooking things based on flavor, not being able to identify, but also confidence in your country and the ingredients that you're projecting and yourself of saying, we don't know what this is, but it tastes good, or we know how to use it. Was it a leap of faith to begin cooking that way, given that your background was fine European dining, where you knew everything, it was very classic?
Yeah. Well, I think we started to believe on creating new memories. I think that's the whole point of what, I mean, yeah, that's very important. I know that probably 70% of the things that you're trying, you are not able to recognize, and we do enjoy doing this. I see people they have no idea what they're eating, but somehow they remember something that they similar, and. I know we're using unknown ingredients, but those unknown ingredients have something that has something related to something that probably you tried before. Yeah, that's a good point, because in a way you are not getting lost. I mean, you're having 16 courses, probably 3 hours, if 1 hour passed by and then you don't get any attention to what you're eating, probably you get lost and you get bored and then you want to leave. We don't want that to happen. So there are a few things that probably you recognize. Of course, you recognize what's, seafood. You recognize something that's coming from the sea. You recognize something that's coming from vegetable roots. But of course, it has to be something that probably you've never tried before. But that's the whole point of coming here. You're coming to Central and yeah, you have to try things that you've never tried before. That's it. That's important. I want you to experience something new. I want you to feel like you're playing with something new. A few things that probably you're trying are things that probably we've tried a few weeks ago. Like, it's kind of, we're playing the game of that you're exploring with us. This is very emotional because, in a way, and we share that. I mean, like we tried this before. I mean, we've tried this like a month ago, and I mean, we have some knowledge because it's something about tradition. It's something that we are just getting this information because you know somebody came from this, you know, far region in the North Amazon or wherever. So this is quite important. But there are a few things that probably, of course, you recognize. I mean, like, of course, we're serving coffee, we're serving cacao. I mean, like, we're serving fish. We are not that weird. but still, I can assure, like, probably that the vegetable roots, the fruits that you're having here, even some of the seafoods you've never seen before, it's quite interesting, you know, the shapes, the textures, the forms, and the taste. They have to be different, difficult, and they have to be intense, and they don't have to be superior to anything. They just have to be like you know, they have to be fluent.
Alive.
Yeah.
How do you find the filter between new, exciting, what you've already had has been tried and tested, and then also pushing your diners up to a point? Where does that balance in your brain lie?
You know, I try to work on my empathy, you know. like, we're cooking for something like, a few days ago I was seeing like, for a week maybe we're cooking for 40 nationalities, yeah, and people is coming from many parts of the world, and they are like expecting something they've never tried before. So they allow us to go a bit far, but not that far, you know. So I know we are, you know, in the limit, you know, and I have to mark that limit where, you know, it cannot be that weird. I mean, that weirdness is for our test kitchen, our lab, but, you know, I work with a team of you know, the guys in the kitchen. They're producing now very weird stuff. I'm saying, like, I mean, this is too weird. I mean, like, just let's make it more like I don't know, accessible to your eyes. It cannot be that, you know, violent, maybe, or like it cannot be that, you know, difficult to understand. So in a way, I get this feeling that, yeah, I mean, probably we're creating new memories, but there's something that you're grabbing from this that you probably know, and you probably don't know it.
It's almost like you're stretched on the arm. You have to touch something, but you could be stretched all the way to the edge.
Yeah, yeah. There is a complicity, I mean, like between us, between the people. If you see the dining room and the kitchen, we're just in front of the people. So we're able to see the people's reaction. It's just not about like we are seeing people like all the time, but I mean, we just see like how the people is reacting to stuff, and we know how far we can go because we keep changing menus and we keep changing dishes. So, I mean, having this interaction with people is amazing because we see how much people is enjoying or probably not enjoying.
You mentioned that you are getting new ingredients all the time. Now that Central has been established for almost a decade, are people from all over Peru bringing you unidentified ingredients? Are they showing up on your back door and they say, we have this thing that we've grown in our culture, and we want to give it to you, and this is how we've done it. They're now coming to you as you opposed to you going to them.
Yeah, I would say there's a new trend now that people is just knocking our doors and they are saying, okay, I'm having this, could you do something with this? I'm like, wow, what is this? Okay, bring it on. But yeah, we used to go for stuff before a lot. I used to go before a lot, and now I'm just staying more in the kitchen. I'm now staying more like in the dining room with a whole team with a researcher or the anthropologist who is always telling me like news about what's going on in our new place in Cusco. But yeah, you know, the systems are changing. This is very, very fun in the end because, you know, seeing people coming with ingredients and seeing people very confident with new ingredients and trying to get, you know, some attention with their food is good because I see that, you know, our kind of identity, you know, it's like it's growing, you know, like we're very proud about our regions, you know, people who's coming from different regions of Peru, and they're just coming to show one ingredient or one thing or just, you know, one piece of landscape, you know.
Family is really important here. You work with your sister and your wife.
Oh yeah.
What we are a family show as well.
Okay, cool.
There's a comfort and tension in working with family. How has it pushed Central and all of your other endeavors to be a better version of itself?
Yeah, I got along very well with my sister, who is the director of Mater, the researcher, and. Of course, I have to get along very well with my wife, and we've been working in Central for maybe 10 years, yeah, and we've been all the time in the past together. So, of course, you get at one point of understanding where you don't even have to speak. I mean, just like you know. We see ourselves and that's it. In the kitchen, things are going very fast, very quick. In Mater Iniciativa, where we are planning, you know, what to do next. Yes, it's difficult to come to an agreement. But yeah, I think we are here, we are very calm. And, you know, I think there's no room for complaints, you know, for being negative and stuff like that. So, but yeah, I mean, things are not that easy as they could sound.
Family has a way of keeping things honest. So are there ever instances where Pia or Malena, your sister, will say, "Chef, that's too weird"?
they are doing all the time that, like, they are all the time. I have this impression that, of course, it's not the impression. I mean, I know that I need them. Like, we work together, and it's not about what I do, what I decide. It's about what we decide. I listen a lot to what Malena, my sister, what she has to say, and I listen a lot. I mean, I'm trying to replicate what Pia is doing in the kitchen. I mean, he's now directing the both kitchens, Koi and Central. I work more on the ideas that are just in between the research area and the restaurant. So, I think at this point we kind of found our positions, and I think that's cool because we have to know how far we can go, and yeah, of course we have to be very honest. I mean, very, very open to listen, and so far things are getting good. I mean, we're having good results.
For a final question, two sides of the same question. For people who are coming to Peru for the first time, what are some common misconceptions and things they don't understand? And then as someone who has been studying Peruvian cuisine, what are some things that you still don't understand and questions that are still raised?
Well, one of the things that I wasn't able to respond was like, why are you doing something that could be like called fine dining, where you are in a country where, you know, like we're still struggling with many, many things, and now I can say we are kind of good embassies to visualize things that probably you've never seen before. We have responsibilities to make our producers grow with their staff. And then, what was the second one?
What are you, as someone who's been studying Peruvian cuisine, like, what don't you still understand, or what are questions that still loom large for you?
I keep mentioning that, you know, nowadays people are thinking about like Peruvian cuisine is this, of course, this melting pot of different cultures that happened, like 500 years ago, from the Incas to the Spanish, then to the Japanese, Chinese, Arabs, Italian. And you know, I mean, what happened with this natural fusion is great, it's amazing. That makes, you know, Lima a very gastronomic destination. But I think we should go like further. I keep telling this to young guys, like, I mean, what if we think what we as Peruvians were eating, or maybe as South Americans, as Latin Americans, as Americans, what we were eating thousands of years ago? Because if we just see our biodiversity is huge, and you know how many ingredients, you know, are just there, and we just don't see them.
Amazing. Well, Chef, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it. I know you have to get to service. Where can people find you? How can they make reservations? How can they follow your research? How can they bring you ingredients to your back door?
No, thank you. Thank you for the interview and for the conversation, of course. Yeah, I'm here in Lima, in Central Restaurante in Barranco, which is our new location. And then we are in Cusco, in the middle of nowhere in the Andes.
Perfect. We're going to take another quick musical break, and then we'll be back with the second part of Snackytunes here on Heritage Radio Network.
Spend some time, a little bit of money. Capture the ride. You'll hold the lens and let's pretend when he's never coming. I'm in some dream, living in your company. I'm in some dream, living in your company. That are haunting for love, and then you go. Spend a lot of money. Spend the night back at your room, wine and a spoon and a little honey. Now I'm in some dream, living in your company. I'm in
on some dream, living in your company. So we go, oh, 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 two wolves that are haunting for yeah, loving the gold. Two wolves that are haunting for loving you go. Two wolves that are haunting for loving we go.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Kathy Irway, and I'm the host of Eat Your Words here on HRN. Every week, I sit down with food writers to talk about their newest work, from colorful cookbooks to food memoirs to exposés on the food industry. It's all meaty topic for discussion. You can find Eat Your Words wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello, and welcome back to Snacky Tunes. We are at the legendary Danger Bird Records studio in beautiful Silver Lake. We are with Tropa Mágica, the Pacheco brothers, David and Renee. Welcome to Snacky Tunes.
That's Renee's mating call.
We're actually only doing answers in whistle form only, so you are all set. Interesting. Interesting insight.
So leave the smoke signals outside.
Yeah. So you guys are brothers. Who's the older brother?
So we like to play around with people, so depends on the day of the week.
Depends
so,
on the day.
Yeah, sometimes Renee could be the older one, sometimes I could be the older one.
All right, so did you guys grow up playing together? When did you guys start getting into music? Mom and dad into music? Grandpa, grandma into music?
No, we were just always together. We grew up together, bonded at a very early age. And as we became teenagers, we went our own separate routes, but we were eventually reunited, not just by music, but also by marijuana.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Renee caught me smoking weed. I started smoking weed a little bit before him, and I would smoke it outside of the house.
Smelled good.
And then he's just like, what are you doing? And I'm like, oh, fuck. And I'm like, you want to try it? And then
if you don't even try it, I'm going to tell my mom.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's always a good thing. You know, as a brother, the way they let your brother do things, be like, I'm going to tell mom and dad.
Yeah, and then we had a day where we both ditched, and we bought like a gram of, at the time, it wasn't clinical weed. It was, you either got like Pretendo or like...
Chronic was the main thing, and Kush was coming out.
Kush was like 25 bucks a gram or something.
We got Chronic, though, and it's the best I've ever heard the Doors, Riders on the Storm.
Yeah, I think the Doors were meant for smoking weed or... Yeah, we maybe were
feel like Pink Floyd too, huh?
Yeah.
We got to do the stoner things, you know?
Yeah, because, I mean, I've been smoking weed long enough, and, I mean, there's a lot of people out there who smoke weed, like at in big amounts, to the point where, like, the best high you're ever going to get was when you first tried it.
Right.
Yeah. And yeah, because, man, those were one of the days where I was like, oh, man, this is something. Now I'm just like, I can, like, you know, function with it. So it's a little different. But when I get to remember back to those days, riding on the storms, leaning my head, thinking I'm floating, but I'm falling off the couch. You know, it was cool, man. It's cool.
Yeah. So when did you guys go from smoking weed and listening to music to smoking weed and making music?
Right away. Once we kind of were, like, both smoking weed, because at the time, like, it was still taboo.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's like, you're not supposed to be smoking weed. Once we started doing that...
Especially with Mexican family.
Yeah, we started bonding, and, like, our interests started kind of bonding as well, you know, forming together. We would go to
shows just to smoke weed sometimes.
Yeah, because, you know, I couldn't smoke at the house, and, like, I wasn't young enough to, like, I wasn't old enough to go to my own places.
But you're like, let him take me to shows. It's a safe spot.
We would go to places like the Smow or like backyard shows or Pear Space. It's not there anymore, but right there on Glendale, it used to be right there.
Yeah.
And we would go to those spots. They were all ages spots, and you could smoke and, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like anybody who's like trying to try something new outside of your limits, you know, you're going to end up betraying either your parents' trust a little bit, you know?
Yeah.
Because, you know, they have their way of...
But it's not supposed to be mean. It's just, you got to be
I didn't do it as an offense to them. Yeah. I just really dug it.
It was fun.
Yeah, it was. And it kept me out of trouble.
So, being Mexican and, like, the punk rock scene, like, with the smell, things like that, which is not always... I mean, it's mostly white at times, like those, like, DIY underground scenes.
Yeah.
Where did you guys feel that you fit in? What did you guys want to do musically? Like, what did you... Or did you just never even see that because it was just like, we love the music, race is not an issue at all?
Yeah, surprisingly for us, it was never an issue. Like, we would see, like, it wasn't until we went to college and we took our first, like, Chicano studies class that we started, like, I blame college, actually, for, like, making us racist.
I didn't know racism existed until I went to college.
It's kind of true. Like, you know, you understand, like, social structures.
It leaves you mad, but, I mean, so...
But it makes sense, you know?
If you can, like, find a solution to know that about you and kind of go your way, and, like, it kind of makes you stronger, you know? Like, whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Or stranger.
So we embraced, like, all types of music. Like, when we were going to the Smell, this was around the time when, like, Mika Miko and Noage were blowing up.
Yeah, because
late 2000s.
Yeah.
Because being Mexican in the punk scene, like, that's all I saw at backyard shows. Like, everybody, you know, like, we all looked like
each
other.
I remember we saw Fiddler, like, at the Five Star Bar.
Oh, wow. But it was, like, our interest in music that took us other places, and we weren't really thinking, like, racism. We were just very much thinking melodies, structures, rhythms.
The cool thing about the LA underground scene was that it was a lot different than the East LA backyard punk scene, because in the East LA backyard punk scene, it was very, like, everything was the same. It felt like everybody was trying to sound either as hard and heavy as you could or as ska as you could. But with, like, places like the Smell and Pear Space, or, like, the little places that were around at the time, the Echo Curio on Sunset, or there was the Alkid Gallery right there on Glendale, too.
Yeah,
those
places, true.
Like, booked a lot of different types of bands. Like, you know, you had the Meishi, or you had, like, you heard of them?
Oh, yeah.
Echo Park was, like, starting to pick up its pace
at its birth of gentrification, like, you know.
Yeah.
But, like, we didn't even know that term at the time. We just knew that, like, there was something going on, and we're like, and then it was until later we're like, oh, that's the term for that.
Yeah, because we were still kids, you know. As kids, you grow up, you're sort of thinking, like, naive. Everything's pretty, everything's beautiful in the world, and then you sort of learn the truth a little bit here and there, and you're kind of like, oh, shit. And so that doesn't, like, we tried not to let that affect us as creatives. We try to just sort of, like, understand that, you know, understand the truth and let that help us continue grow as creatives.
Awesome. Well, let's hear a song, and then we're going to get back into, when we come back, we'll talk about the first band and how you guys started defining your sound.
Yeah, definitely.
What's the first song you guys are going to play?
The first song we're going to play is called Morena.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Any story behind it?
Morena, it actually started with a riff that Jason would play on sound checks, and I'm like, hey, play that riff again, and then we wrote a melody around it and some chord structure around it.
Oh, yeah, do you want to shout out the other two guys in the room?
Yeah, so we have Davis on piano. He plays piano, keyboard, or like synth, organ kind of sounds. And then Jason, who's been with us, he's actually been a fan of of our music since like before Tropa Mágica, and he once posted a video on Instagram where he's playing one of our songs, and then 4 months later he joined the band.
That has got to be the most awesome, surreal. That was a good day. That was a good call or email,
and
right?
It's funny because he was joking around saying, "Oh, you're hired," and 4 months later, sure enough.
Man,
there you go.
Hey, dream big. Yeah. You never know. You never know. Take a risk. All right, here we go. Tropa Mágica live on Snacky Tunes at Danger Bird Record Studios. That rips real hard.
Thank you.
So before you were the band that you are now, you actually had an earlier iteration, The Commons.
Yeah.
And you guys, in addition to that, also sort of defined a new type of sound. that was sort of like cumbia, but like your own sort of like punk rock thing. So how did you guys start your first band? When did you guys decide that you wanted to play together? And then how did you start to define your sound, especially when it was something completely new?
We decided to play together when David needed a drummer.
Oh.
And I already had been practicing drums myself.
And you had the blackmail weed thing on it, too.
So everything fell into place from there.
Yeah, and then, like, coming out of the, like, experiencing the L.A. scene around that time, you know, like, late 2000s, you know, before 2010, it was very interesting because at that same time we went to college. You know, we had dropped out of like college, like community college, and we were just working, trying to do music. And,
yeah.
And then we decided to go back to school, and it was around that time where we started like kind of like embracing our roots more and trying to like find like our identity per se. And we started listening to more of regional music. You know, like the Ruta Chicha had a big influence on us, but since we had like all this like these years of experience with bands like Mika Miko, Meishi, you know, we weren't gonna be able to do it authentically anymore. So at that point,
because that punk had seeped in.
Yeah, at that point, we were like, we were
once
trying
to get inside of you.
We were trying to be No Age for a good while. Like we were trying to do it as a two piece, and then
that was hard.
Yeah,
Kumi is a two piece. I don't know if that's
You need the bass.
You need that bass. You need that driving bass.
And then we went through like a dozen basses, just trying to like gel, find our sound, and
find our voice.
Yeah,
it took us a lot of ingesting to do. We were very curious, so we were experiencing a lot of different bands, going to different, you know, just going to different areas that
And then Boyle Heights, that's when we started noticing more like Latino bands, like people that like had similar backgrounds like as us. But it was kind of weird because we felt like outcasts there because we felt like the music we like was too white, you know, like, and they were more like hardcore, like rootsy, like, you know, like you got to play cumbia straight up like this. And we felt very like, distortion.
Yeah.
This hit, yeah.
I mean, did you find as you were sort of defining yourself and you find yourself one foot in, you know, the punk scene, which is like the white scene, and then like the Boyle Heights, which is more of the Mexican scene. Like, how long did it take for you to sort of find comfortability and acceptance with the music you were making? Like, when did that start to gel?
3 years. It was with the Commons. It was 3 years. It wasn't until we saw this band called Cumbia Queers from Argentina. They came to Boyle Heights to play at this little dive bar, and they do like, it's like a bunch of girls, you know, ladies, women, they do the cumbia style, and it's very aggressive, like, you know, with distorted guitars, synths.
I don't think it's aggressive. I just think it's unapologetic.
Yeah,
they're
like,
gonna do what they're there to do and what they wanted to hear.
They did a cumbia version of Iron Man, but Black Sabbath, and that's when Renee and I looked at each other, and we were just like, boom, like light bulb went on, and it's like, it's okay to be different. Like,
because prior to hearing them play cumbia in that form, in that style, in which it wasn't just like your typical clean, or not typical, that's messed up, just like it wasn't your clean.
Traditional.
Yeah, it wasn't your cut clean, you know, form of cumbia. This was something a lot more grittier and something that we could accept as like cumbia punk, you know?
Yeah.
That attitude like just really called to us and let us know like, it's okay what you're doing. You know, like you guys aren't playing it the way it's supposed to be sounding, but through hearing them, it was like a beautiful blessing, like, keep doing it. Because they did a cover of Iron Man in a cumbia, you know, cumbia style. I'd never heard anything like that.
So it's like, and now, so now for those of y'all that are listening that don't necessarily know what cumbia is, it's very much defined by its bass rhythms and its percussions, and the percussions would be very much like a guido sound, which sounds like a...
So any song that's on like 4-4, you can turn it into cumbia.
I mean, you guys have been known to cover Nirvana.
Yeah, we covered some Nirvana songs. We did, we joked around and played a bunch of different little cumbia melodies.
Now, you did the Commons for a while.
6 years.
6 years. And then you decided to change to Tropa Mágica. What made the change? Why did you want to change? And was it hard to rebrand yourself as a band, but not changing, like, who you guys are? It wasn't like you, like, one guy left.
Yeah.
Like, what made you want to decide to change it up, and how did the fans, how did the people who loved you guys deal with that as well?
So this is a three-part question.
Three-part question.
So
What made you want to change?
What made us want to change? How did that change go, and how did the fans take it?
Yeah.
My answer for the first one might be different to David's, but for me it was just very simple. It was an evolution. When we started the first band, it was the first name that, or when we started the Commons, the name was just something we grabbed really quick and ran with it because we needed a name. But as we kept growing,
what
as
we
musicians,
kind of embraced was like, you know, it wasn't the name that was going to define us. It was our sound that was going to define us.
And yeah, and so afterwards we realized like, okay, now we want to switch it up because for me, like, we had changed as musicians, our sound completely shifted, and so it was like David came up to me and was like, what do you think about changing the band name to this? And at first I struggled, but it immediately became clear to me. It's like, yeah, we've become something else. We should call ourselves for something, because now we were able to name ourselves as opposed to just take whatever name we could have. Yeah, so we had a more bigger sense of purpose, and we knew what we wanted of what we were going to continue to do.
Yeah, because with the Commons, what happened was that we had another band called Hello, My Name is Red. The acronym for that was HMNR, and we did that for 4 years, and then we stopped that band to do the Commons, and we had a radio show at KXIU, and they were like, so what should we bill you guys under? And we're like, okay, well, we threw that name out there, and then it just kind of stuck.
Yeah, because we played a show once right before we became the Commons as a no-name band, where I did a song without drums. It was really awkward.
What inspired the shift, too, was also like, you know, 2017 for the Commons, our band, it was a really great year. We played Coachella, you know, we had done Tropicalia. We got a lot of good press, LA Weekly, you know, LA Times were talking about our band. And to me, it felt like, all right, what are we going to do as a band that's going to surpass this, that's going to, you know, kind of create the next thing? And in my head, it's just like, there's nothing. We're like, what, we're going to win a Grammy as the Commons? And I didn't feel that was going to happen with the Commons. So I was just like, you know, just reinvent ourselves, let it die so that something stronger could come out of it.
Like a pahonix, phoenix.
From the ashes. Yeah. And then the fans. The fans come with you?
Slowly, yeah. Like, I think now, like, it's gaining more legitimacy as, like, we got booked for, like, Desert Days, you know.
I think it just took a little while because they didn't know what songs they were going to come in here. They were used to hearing the songs that we had laid out for them. But until now that we, like, been producing some work for them to hear, I feel like they're kind of like,
the water's not that cold.
I'm down to dip in.
Yeah.
And then we're touring, and so as people are getting more excited, like, oh, like, we haven't toured, like, since last year, and we're a band that, like, constantly tours, so. Yeah, like, us now releasing an EP, singles, and an LP coming out, well, which, by the time this airs, it should already be out, it creates definitely, like, a foundation for which previous fans can now base their judgment, because before, it's just like, oh, my God, they're just changing, and there was nothing to back it up, unless you're, like, diehard fan, yeah, which we do have some.
Our first show to an audience of Tropa Magica, there were people who showed up, but nobody knew what they were in for, and so they didn't know exactly how to react.
But they were down. They were down to swim with this.
Awesome. All right, well, let's hear our next song. What are we going to hear?
The next song is going to be Cupacabras, to give you an example of the psychedelic cumbia punk version of what we do.
Awesome. All right,
Cupacabras.
Here we go.
We'll be right back.
Oh man, that rips. It rips so good. So I want to go back a little bit into the process of inventing a new sound.
Okay.
Because I know we touched on it a little bit in the last segment, but I really don't want to undermine or underplay really how amazing it is to come up with something that unique. And in setting out to do this new sound, did you guys have a conversation about it? Did you guys go, we want to do it? And because I know that you've named it the Psychedelic Cumbia Punk. Like, when did you realize that you were on this new journey? When did you realize that you had this new sound that did take from, you know, the traditional cumbia sound and the backyard punk scene?
That, I think, started with the song called Psychedelic Dream, in which it was very guitar-oriented, and then Renee began playing this drum that kind of became our signature kind of sound, guitar and drum sound. Which is like, what you call, like, what do you call that? Like a soca, no?
It's not what I call it. It's what it's called. It's called soca. It's and like a Jamaican. A lot of people, when they hear it, they'll think, oh, it's reggaeton.
Yeah.
But no, hell no, reggaeton took it from soca.
Yeah. And but it was definitely a process. And once we got in that vibe of like, okay, this is our sound, like, it just like, you know, and that was always our goal, because I feel like any great band, you recognize them by their sound, you know. You don't recognize them by their name or their logo. Like, I mean, that's a factor. Like, you know, Rolling Stones have the tongue or something. The Doors have their logo. But you recognize their sound. And then for us, that was very important. Like, we need to develop a sound that's ours. And so, I mean, we were performing with bands like Chicano Batman, you know. Just like all sorts of bands that were like blowing up, and so the competition was real, you know. But it was also very cool to see like bands like Chicano Batman like touring with Jack White and like kind of demonstrating that like, hey, like making it as a musician is like very possible, you know, coming from East LA. And so,
I mean, as you've seen the demographics in America change, because obviously growing up in LA and East LA,
yeah,
you know, there's Hispanic, Mexican.
Yeah,
like it's
so
it's,
you don't feel like a minority in Southern California,
right? But once you get out, you know, and as you see different cities change with different people, do you find more acceptance across the country for your music, or does that not even play into it? Like, you just, you know, now because you have such a unique sound and are well known, it doesn't matter what the community is, people just love the music.
I think we were,
no, it does a little bit, because when we were the Commons, you're going to think like, oh, this might be like a
garage
white
band or something.
Sure. White boys garage band. But now you hear Tropa Manica, you know, you might think like, oh, you know, like, just, it's like maybe the carnival's in town. You know?
What we were lucky and fortunate and blessed with is that, like, you know, we met good, like, networks, you know, like Burger Records was really interested in us when, like, this is like 2014. And, like, you know, they were still doing a lot of stuff. And so when we first toured, they presented the tour, which was like really cool, because people would come out to shows because we were a burger band, you know, quote unquote, like we were a burger band, and they had no idea what we sounded like until they saw like a poster in their local, like, you know, local community, and they're like, hey, there's a burger band, and then they look us up and they're like, you know, you guys don't sound like a burger band or look like a burger band.
I mean, I have to imagine that the vibe when you guys jump on, especially your like normal indie punk show. Mm. Probably gets a little bit more dancey, a little bit more, like, do you see kids who normally would maybe just be arms folded or a little bit more stoic, get a little bit more loose?
You know, it's a trip, because when we toured with Fiddlar, we did like 3 dates with them in San Francisco, Santa Cruz, and Seattle, and, you know, their audience is predominantly like white audience, I would assume, but they have like a good Latino audience. They have a diverse audience, but it's predominantly white. Yeah. And
it was funny watching them dance cumbia.
Yeah, they got down, like, you know, it's like.
Their enthusiasm was just so that, like, that's at the end of the day, like, what you give it up to. Like, it's not to make fun of them, you know, like, why I pointed that out. It's just that their enthusiasm was in the right place.
It's like us like dancing to bands like we were saying earlier, like Mika Miko and stuff, and like being brown kids, you know, dancing to like.
Yeah.
And it's like vice versa.
Yeah, we look like a Doug Trio, you know, causing an earthquake. Pokemon reference, hey.
Let me tell you about a kid that turns into a car one day.
Inside joke.
Now that you got the new album coming out, you know, you're playing festivals as the new band, where do you see the band going? Where do you want to go? Because now that you've hit the reset button, like you said, you did Coachella, you got people talking about you, but you know, obviously you want to get that with the new band, but then how do you go beyond what you did with the Commons?
Leave the U.S.
Yeah.
Tour internationally. That's the goal. I mean, to become an international band where we tour Europe, Mexico, South America, because I feel like once you break over there in those areas, then when we come back to the States, it'll be like, it's just like people like our followers sometimes, you know, which just kind of sucks, but like, it's like mass thinking, you know, like group think, and it's like, you know, if everybody
you're not,
thinks
you're not going to change history. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, it is
so,
what it is.
So, and then like, in a sense, like,
you got to go with the flow. Yeah. It's like they told Bruce Lee, you know, like,
yeah.
It's like but everybody, fight the water,
but,
be the
but
water.
This is not to say that anybody that's like picking up to what we're doing right now, like that we categorize under that, like now, like we really appreciate like everybody that's tuning into Tropa Mágica. Like, we have a lot of new people that are tuning into it for the first time who don't even know that we had another band, which is really cool.
That's bonus music.
Yeah.
You know, where you get in the band and you go like, wait, they had another band with three
exactly.
albums?
But the funny thing is that like the moment we decided to call it Tropa Mágica, everyone was like, oh my God, no. It was like, bitch, when we were the Commons, what? Where was that shit at? So y'all gotta lay off and, you know, just chill out. Let the current flow. Calm the fuck down.
But now they're with you, and now they're gonna see you.
Yeah, well, definitely. I mean, whether they're with us or they're not, like we appreciate those who do and reach out to us, but like I've told David, like, you know, like, because when David and I, we practice by ourselves, like, just doing stuff, whether there's an audience or not, we're going to give it our all.
I mean, I'm seeing it today.
So that's, like, that's something that's just beautiful. And, like, for those who do ride along the journey, thank you. Appreciate you. And there's more to come.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, I want to thank you guys. I want to make sure we have enough time for one more song. But where can people get the new album? Where can people find you online?
People can find us on www.tropamagica.com or like on anything, like all social media, Spotify.
LinkedIn for the classy people. Just kidding. Just kidding. Just kidding.
I don't
kidding,
think we have one of those.
So what are you going to take us out with?
We're going to take you out with a little medley. It's like an instrumental medley. Well, the first part is actually from the new album. It's called Ya Viejo. And then it's going to go into a...
We wrote it to our older selves.
Yeah, this is a song that Renee and I wrote.
The day we're hunched over, gray hair, and just like, this is what we wrote.
Like when our Quincy Jones documentary
exactly.
comes out.
Exactly. Yeah, see, yeah, man. Because the Quincy Jones documentary came
Have
out.
You seen
and
it?
It's
on
really
Netflix?
And it's really more about his final act, reminiscing on his first acts, first and second act.
Okay.
But I really just appreciated this idea of like,
hey, you got to make art and music that your future self has to live up to.
Yeah, all right.
Awesome. Well, I want to
do
thank
it for posterity.
Andy Dangerbird Records.
Thank you, Andy, for making it sound good.
Woo!
Making put some reverb on it.
And thank you to Heritage Radio. This is Snacky Tunes, Tropa Mágica. See you next week. One last sip of beer before here we go.
The last sip.
Recuerdo los días llenos de alegría y sigo esperando un lindo recuerdo que me trae la vida sin decir adiós.
talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, snacky tunes.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.